Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome to our first podcast of 2022. We're delighted to have with us in this episode our security editor as well, Alex Scrogston. Hello, Alex.
Hello there.
So last time you were on, Alex, was in May of last year. And you were talking to us then about the SolarWinds attack and the Colonial Pipeline and things like that. You're also looking forward to getting back to theatre and into art galleries. And this was in May, so it was the summer. Did that happen?
In fact, I've got theatre tickets for this weekend. I'm going to see Wuthering Heights at the National Theatre. Apparently it's a folk musical. I don't quite know what that entails, but if Kate Bush isn't involved in some way, I'm going to ask for a refund.
Well, that would be understandable. And we were all at that stage looking forward to meeting up in person for the first time in over a year, which we did by the banks of the Thames.
It was at a pub restaurant. We weren't just hanging about on the banks, just like some unruly youths. There was like actual arrangements.
It was a little bit like that.
Drinking at the skate park.
Yeah.
So good starts to 2022, guys. New year. I can see a bunch of nonplussed faces.
Well, the start of the year is a long time ago now. January was the longest month on living record, I believe, or at least it felt like
it. It was incredibly long.
I can't tell you what I did or what happened. It just lasted time, is all I know.
Yeah. Yeah, and good riddance to it, I would say. I got COVID.
I forgot about that. Sorry. Sorry, that's awful. I just thought, nothing of note happened. Oh, Brian survived COVID. Yeah, should have.
Yeah, I did do that. And I've in the meantime done my neck in. 22 months of working from home and hunched up over a laptop has not done me a great deal of good. Moving swiftly on, top line on the podcast, where we're going to go today. Alex, you're taking us to the Ukraine via the Log4j vulnerability and exploit.
Yes, what would happen if I didn't say yes to that? I don't think I could be bothered, quite frankly. But yes, that's my plan. That's my objective, is to
thank God for that.
Paint a bit of a picture of some of the highlights of the past 2 months, or lowlights.
Brilliant.
Depending on your viewpoint.
We might end up, we could have just ended the podcast there. Be like, beginning of the year's not been great, guys. Thanks for listening.
Yeah. Okay, well, more on that soon. Caroline, talking of cyber attacks, how they extend to umbrellas.
Yes, the umbrella company industry has been rocked by a series of cyber attacks over the last couple of months. So I've been having a delve into that and the impact it's having on contractors, and also trying to get to the bottom of maybe who's behind it. But I can't really say too much because I don't know how well resourced our lawyers are. So, but yeah, I'm going to have to talk around that very delicately.
That does sound very intriguing. And you've done quite a good kind of analytical roundup of that.
Quite a good. Well, that's nice. Faint praise.
It's a brilliant piece.
B minus.
Yeah, could try harder.
You don't really like compliments. And that's a piece that we're running in this issue of the easing. And it is a very excellent piece. Claire, neurodiversity is your topic this time around.
So I'm going to talk about a story I wrote a little while ago about EY launching an office, and the office is catered to people who might have conditions such as ADHD, autism, or dyslexia.
Very cool. That's an interesting wee story. So I'll be talking rubbish, namely junk in space, how a graph database is tracking debris, which is in near-Earth orbits. So that towards the very end of the episode. But Alex, if we can start with you as our guest. New year, new attacks?
Or last year's attacks hanging over into 2022, to be strictly accurate about it. Yeah. So that a lot's been happening since I last disgraced the podcast with my presence. And ultimately, it all seems to come back to the same nexus of cyber criminal / state-backed activity. And I try to say this carefully. It's important not to create an atmosphere of fear, uncertainty, and doubt around security. And yet also it's very hard not to. So I'm going to take you back to December, when the when the Log4j, or some people are calling it Logforge, incident occurred. So Logforge, it's an Apache project, and it's one of the most widespread pieces of open source software. It provides logging capabilities for Java applications, and it's been around since 1999. It was initially released, the current version being Log4j2, which has been around since 2014. The vulnerability in question, which is tracked as CVE-2021-44228, was reported at the end of November to the Apache Software Foundation, but not publicly disclosed at the time. To give you the highest level version, it's a remote code execution flaw that exists in the way the Log4j component interacts with JNDI, which stands for Java Naming and Directory Interface. Basically, an attacker who gains access to logging messages can inject fraudulent messages that enable them to achieve what's known as arbitrary code execution, and therefore, and from that point, exploit a vulnerable system to, say, upload ransomware to it, conduct further cyber attacks, exfiltrate data. The reason this caused a panic when it came to public attention in December is because Logforge is used pretty much everywhere. You would be very, very hard pressed to find any supplier with a software package who wasn't using it to some degree. AWS, Cisco, everybody, VMware. It's everybody who any of us would write about, including multiple security suppliers as well. Patches came out because it was such a fundamental vulnerability. There have been subsequent vulnerabilities, subsequent updates as well. The positive thing to come out of this is that the community response was so effective. If you remember the Millennium Bug, which Brian and I are certainly old enough to remember.
Oh, yes, I remember it well.
Turned out not to be a problem. But only turned out not to be a problem because a lot of people worked very hard to stop it from being a problem. And this is kind of what we've seen here. Exploitation so far has been very limited. I think it was Sophos researchers who were talking about that a couple of weeks ago, saying that the volume of attacks was far lower than what they might have thought it would be. That is not, however, to say that there haven't been incidents or that there might not be more incidents, because malicious actors, whether they be financially motivated cyber criminals or state-backed groups, often enjoy to spend a few months just cruising around inside their target networks, moving about, getting the lay of the land. It's sort of like a, you know, like an extended vacation. If you go to a city for, you know, an extended period of time, you get to know it a little bit. You find some little cafes you like. This is the cyber equivalent of that. They take their time. They get everything they need, and then this is where my analogy falls apart.
It sounds more like a trip to an all-inclusive resort. You can just really stuff yourself.
It's a better analogy, isn't it? And like an all-inclusive resort, except you don't blow up the all-inclusive resort at the end of it unless you've had a really good time. Maybe you leave it 2 stars on TripAdvisor or something. Ultimately, you know, they will steal and leak data or deploy ransomware or bring down your systems or whatever. So it is entirely possible that there are loads and loads of naughty, naughty people kicking around inside everybody's systems, and they just haven't done anything yet. We don't know. But one attack that we are pretty certain was linked to Logforge was an attack against various departments of the Ukrainian government earlier in January, which our colleague Bill Goodwin wrote about at the time. I was having a day off. Often the way that I take a day off and something awful happens.
Yeah, it's usually a signal, isn't it? For,
yeah, I'm away. So, but fortunately, Bill is one of the best investigative journalists in the UK. So is more than capable of taking up any slack. In any case, the hacking group exploited applications containing the Log4j, Log4Shell vulnerability to take control of targeted servers, launched various denial of service attacks against state organizations. The biggest effect of this attack, planting of malicious malware, Ukrainian government systems, which malware called Whispergate, which is reminiscent of NotPetya from several years ago, in that it sort of looks and behaves a bit like a ransomware, but it's not ransoming your systems, it's just destroying everything. So it's a highly destructive attack, very, very hard to recover from. And of course, Ukraine being the subject of, I think we can say, bullying, basically, by Russia at this point without our lawyers getting involved. It's fairly well accepted in cyberland that this attack was the work of groups linked to the Russian government. It appear to have actually been based out of Belarus, which is the a small country just to the north of Ukraine that also shares a border with Russia, but is historically much closer to Russia geopolitically than many of the other former Soviet states, the Baltics, Ukraine. And that, of course, leads us to to everything that's going on around Ukraine, the ongoing escalation, the potential for an armed conflict, and what that might bring in terms of the cyber environment. It's pretty well accepted at this point that we will see some kind of incident should this escalate into open conflict, that there will be attempts to compromise and attack targets in Ukraine and possibly in Western Europe. And our own National Cybersecurity Center and our American counterparts and many of their equivalent agencies in countries such as Germany and the Netherlands have been warning organizations, particularly operators of critical infrastructure, which would be utilities, energy, telecoms networks, government agencies, to take precautions just on the off chance, which leads on to the final piece in the puzzle, which is a developing story from the last few days that began a few days ago in Germany when an oil distribution company was attacked, we think by ransomware. And this seems at this point, although I stress this is developing today, to be part of a series of attacks against other companies that are active in oil distribution. There are a number of port terminal facilities in Belgium and the Netherlands that are in trouble as well. Far, far too early to accuse the Russian government of being behind these. It would be jumping to conclusions to do so, but it's certainly possible.
All very solemn stuff. Bill's piece that you mentioned there, Alex, the National Bank of Ukraine also got attacked. So it wasn't only Ukrainian government websites and so on that were under attack, but if you like, civilian, which is a I suppose a big and interesting thing, that the rules of cyber warfare are not really set, are they, in the way that they are for physical or kinetic warfare. We don't really know what.
Well, the difficulty we find ourselves in is that we've been, and I think a lot of researchers would probably agree with me, we've been in a sort of low-level cyber Cold War with Russia for some time now. You saw it kind of explode into life more noticeably last year. But it's been going on for a while. They hack us. We accuse them of hacking us. We're probably hacking them right back. It's just our guys aren't getting caught, and the tech media is based in the West, so it's not really talked about in the same way. But you're right. And what is concerning is that there hasn't been yet a situation that might degenerate into a shooting war, kinetic war, as you said, being also a term we can use here. In the cyber age, we haven't officially found ourselves in a war with Russia or China or any other countries deemed hostile to the West's interests. So we don't know how it will play out in any way. There are no rules. This was never set down. People have been arguing for there to be rules for some time now. I wrote an interview with Mikko Hipponen at F-Secure a couple of years ago, in which he was talking about the need for a Geneva Convention for cyber weapons. Obviously, that hasn't happened, and I don't think it will happen until, unfortunately, until such time as there is an open state of conflict.
I think I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast about my terrible, unfortunate neck injury. I don't know if I've mentioned that to anyone. But when I was having my, I was in the osteopath the other day in Oxford, and there was a loud sonic boom, which was nothing to do with my osteopathy, but I figured out later in the day that what it was most probably was a Typhoon jet being scrambled from Bryce Norton, which is quite close to here, to interface with Russian aircraft, no doubt. So yeah, there is definitely stuff going on, and I suppose that's a small example of this could start to impact us a bit.
One would expect it. I think at this point it's safer to assume that attacks will center on Ukraine, and that attacks on NATO countries will depend to a large extent on whether or not we deploy any kind of military response. But if they were to occur, all bets are off as to what might be deemed a legitimate target by Russian state actors. If they choose to attack the NHS, then the consequences don't bear thinking about, particularly during a pandemic. It's a reminder to me of how interconnected and dependent the world has become on IT and technology.
And it's weird, that little story you told there, Alex, about you've got this kind of piece of dodgy code, basically, which is a vulnerability being exploited, but the connection between that and the ramifications of that for a situation like Russia's pressure on Ukraine. Interesting joining of dots.
There's another interesting little point to make around the vulnerabilities that these groups use to get inside their targets, and that a lot of particularly groups backed by, or groups that we think are backed by Russian spy agencies, that they will have banked various weaponized vulnerabilities that they can use in the event of a conflict situation, that they have probably compromised a large number of targets already, and they'll be sitting in there waiting around for that to kick off as an insurance policy. So you know, if a war does begin, you can probably expect to see more critical vulnerabilities surfacing in various products that will have been found and weaponized by APT groups. Of course, once they're used, they're used, and we can reverse engineer them and fix them.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of quandary that a threat actor finds themselves in when using a zero-day vulnerability. That once you've blown your zero-day vulnerability, it's blown. Yeah. It's out there. It's not like dropping a bomb on someone.
No, I think
someone drops a bomb on me. Yeah. I can't reverse engineer another bomb. I can't do anything much. But.
No, you'd be finished. Well, I don't know if Vladimir Putin's cyber hench people will be targeting umbrella companies.
Yeah, it's a bit like what Alex said at the start of his bit. You know, lots of last year's stuff has been dragged into 2022. And that's the case for the umbrella companies with regard to the fact they're coming under attack from cyber criminals at the moment. What we're talking about here is the fact that potentially sort of thousands of IT contractors, but also any kind of contractor, anyone who works in a sort of self-employed capacity, which could include, I'd say, a lot of IT contractors, but also social workers, healthcare workers, locum doctors, that kind of thing. Potentially thousands of those people across the UK have had their payday cycles disrupted in recent months by a series of suspected, just in case the lawyers are listening, suspected ransomware attacks that have targeted umbrella companies that are responsible for processing the payroll of these sort of self-employed workers, contractors, as we call them. So the first of these attacks occurred in late September 2020, against a company known as Giant Group. And then in mid-January, two separate but very similar attacks were inflicted on two other very large umbrella companies. They're called Parasol and Brookson Group. And in all three cases, the firms involved were forced to proactively remove all of their external facing systems from the internet. And they effectively went dark for several days. So I think Brookson, their whole website and everything just disappeared off the internet. Well, both of them as well, I think, have had to resort to taking their phone lines offline and all that kind of thing. So it's causing a lot of disruption externally, but also they're kind of like black box organizations. So we don't actually know what's going on inside them in the wake of these attacks. But what we do know is a lot of the contractors who are paid through these companies haven't been paid. The ones who've been affected by this latest round of attacks, at the time of recording, I wrote a story yesterday saying that there's still contractors who haven't been paid. I was speaking to one earlier this week who said his last pay packet came in mid-November, so he hasn't been paid for quite a long time now because of this. Well, just because of the way the payroll cycle works, some contractors get paid monthly, some get paid weekly. So the way this has fallen means he was, I think at the time of talking to him, he's about $3,500 down on his money, which isn't ideal. The statement I got through from Parasol yesterday, they said that they were still trying to reconcile people's payments and trying to get everything back up and running again. It's difficult to sort of know really how the impact this has had on their payroll processes. Some of the contractors I've been speaking to, some of them do work in designing payroll systems, and they're sort of saying, like, you know, the sums of money we're supposed to be getting through, when you compare them to what we're actually getting through, that we think a lot of the calculations here are just being based on guesswork and assumptions. So it's really hard to know what state these attacks have left there in sort of back office systems in and that kind of thing, which is quite interesting and sort of scary to think about as well. So why are the umbrella companies being targeted? There's a couple of different schools of thought on this, but I'm going to talk about one or maybe another one as well. But the ones that are least likely to get us in trouble with anyone's lawyers. So basically, to the uninitiated, umbrella companies process the payroll for large numbers of contractors who provide their services via employment agencies to end clients in the private and public sector. And this sort of creates a sort of labour supply chain through which a sum of money will pass from the end client to the agency, then onto the umbrella company, and finally the contractor. So there's all this money flowing through the system. So the end client needs to pay the contractor for that work, and it passes through all those entities on the way, with everyone taking whatever deductions they need to take for tax and fees and that kind of thing. According to estimates, there's approximately 600,000 contractors employed through umbrella companies, but it's likely there are lots more now. The last time anyone did any figures was pre-April 2021, which is before the IR35 reforms came in. And since then, a lot more contractors have had to work through umbrella companies. So it is likely those numbers are a lot higher now. But during a typical week, an umbrella company will be sitting on huge sums of salary payments from the contractors they employ. So the simplest explanation as to why umbrella companies are suddenly being targeted by cyber criminals is that they are simply just cash-rich businesses that ransomware fiends, or whatever you want to call them, think, you know, will be worth going after. So that's one side of it. I mean, in terms of who's actually behind the attacks, again, you don't know is it just opportunistic cyber criminals. In the wake of the IR35 reforms, there's been a lot of media coverage of umbrella companies, people sort of questioning, you know, what value do they bring to any of this, because they are effectively just payroll processing companies. So it might be, but you know, another theory is that they've gone from being kind of companies no one ever really talked about or knew they existed to suddenly being a bit more high profile. So there's that side of things. If you talk to a lot of contractors, there's a lot of people who aren't very happy about the fact they have to work through umbrella companies now. So there's some people who suggest, oh, maybe it's a disgruntled IT contractor who's going after these companies. But at the moment, no one really knows, as well as sort of not really knowing who's behind the attacks. It's also very difficult to say with any degree of accuracy just how much money is flowing through an umbrella company. I mean, but what is quite interesting, there was a case that came to light this week about an umbrella company called Umbrella Care that primarily dealt with contractors working in the healthcare space. They went into liquidation at the behest of HMRC, and they owed HMRC basically £36.4 million in unpaid tax. So that kind of gives you a partial steer, I think, on just how much money is churning around in these companies. So that was just one umbrella company, and they owed £36.4 million in unpaid tax HMRC, but that would obviously only be a small percent. Well, you know, it would be a percentage of the amount of money that company is sort of processing. So yeah, that's kind of it. They are big, you know, big businesses. What these attacks have done is kind of brought into sort of sharper focus that there are huge sums of money being moving around these firms, but umbrella companies or the umbrella sector is still unregulated. They are a little bit kind of self-policing in that they've got their own sort of industry associations that people can get kind of accreditation and stuff, but there's no actual statutory regulation for umbrella companies. And you know, these, like I said, these attacks sort of brought that into sharper focus. People sort of questioning, like, if all this money is moving around these companies, why aren't they being more closely monitored? Why isn't there the equivalent of, say, like the Financial Conduct Authority sort of keeping an eye on them and that kind of thing? And but also, like I say, these attacks have left lots of contractors sort of out of pocket. And if you go on LinkedIn or you go on Twitter, also just some of the emails I've been getting through, people sort of saying, like, I haven't been able to pay sort of my mortgage, I haven't been able to pay my bills, I'm sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place because the money is tied up in these companies and they're not paying us. And because there isn't any regulation, there is relatively little that a contractor can do to challenge that and try and chase down their money and things like that. So there's sort of been renewed arguments that the sector should be regulated so that potentially if a firm suffers a cyber attack, these regulations would ensure that they have to have sort of robust disaster recovery and business continuity processes in place so they can bounce back quicker from these attacks and obviously minimise the disruption to sort of contractor payday cycles. There's sort of other stories as well about other umbrella companies going out of business as well that I'm looking into at the minute. And some of those companies have hit the wall, if you like, and no contractors have been paid as a result of that either. So there's another sort of thing. So, you know, if a company goes out of business, if there was regulation in place, there could be regulations that would ring fence salaries for contractors. So if a company went out of business, contractors would still get paid. So that's just part of it, really. But yeah, it's all kind of interconnected, shining a light on the fact there's lots of money swilling around umbrella companies, but they're not regulated. And is that sensible? The government's under loads of pressure or growing pressure to push through regulation. But I think that was first sort of suggested that they should do that back in 2017, and nothing's really happened. They're in the middle of there's a government consultation on it at the minute going on, but it's still just progress is just glacial, really. So it's stressing a lot of people out.
Caroline, who's making the calls for regulation? Who are the kind of actors here?
There are, well, contractors, but there's lots of stakeholder groups who are quite keen to see regulation. Some of the umbrella companies themselves, they are supporting regulation because they are doing everything they're supposed to. They're behaving impeccably. You know, they might have the most robust cyber attack protections in place. They are, how can I explain this? Well, like I said a minute ago, there are lots of contractors who aren't very happy about the fact they have to work through umbrella companies. And one of the reasons for this is there is quite a lot of bad behaviour and bad actors in that market. There's been lots of bad practice that's come to light. There was a big report last year from the Loan Charge APPG group. That was basically called How Contracting Should Work. And it's worth reading, but it's about basically why the umbrella market and employment agencies sort of market needs to be cleared up, because it is a bit of a wild west at the minute. So some of the bad behaviors sort of outlined in that report were things like, as the money passes through that sort of supply chain I mentioned, as it passes from sort of end client to agency and then to the umbrella company, when it passes from the umbrella company to the contractor, there are deductions that have to be taken from that pay packet, you know, in terms of, you know, tax and things like that. But some umbrella companies are taking other payments, and that goes unnoticed by the contractor. It's called skimming. So they'll take quite sort of relatively small amounts out of the pay packet, but if you take small amounts of money out of, say, you know, 10,000 people's pay packets, that skims off a nice sum of money for the umbrella company that might go undetected. So there's things like that. There's a story I'm working on at the minute around the fact some umbrella companies withhold holiday pay from their contractors. Like, these are the ones that aren't behaving very well. So contractors are out of pocket for that. And yeah, so regulation is something that's hope would stamp that out. But there are umbrella companies out there who, you know, don't skim people's pay packets. They pay everything they're supposed to. They pay the tax owed to HMRC. They make sure their contractors get holiday pay. and everything is done by the book. So they're the ones pushing for regulation. There's a lady who's doing a lot of work on this. She heads up the Employment Status Forum called Rebecca Seeley Harris. She's written the government a policy paper on how regulations should work. So there's lots of support on that from lots of different areas, because it's a wild west out there, as the Loan Charge APPG say.
I wanted to ask you a question, Caroline, about so the Brookson Group, they self-reported to the NCSE. I mean, what would you get then from that? I mean, if you self-report to the NCSE, I mean, what could a company expect in terms of help? Alex, do you know what?
I think it is just a case of we're trying to be on the front foot with this and show we're behaving impeccably and doing everything we're supposed to. But yeah. Apart from that, I don't know, Alex.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah.
Self-reporting to the NCSC is a good first step, and one that, you know, any company that's a victim of a cyber attack should be doing. It's essentially best practice. It's also, you know, a net positive in terms of managing your own reputation, because companies will frequently have their reputations impugned or hit if they fall victim to a cyber attack. Just by doing the right thing, you can create a lot of goodwill. So there's that benefit to it, that the NCSC support that you will get is generally around incident response. So they'll, you know, help you establish what happened, guide you in mitigating the immediate impacts, and then provide you with guidance on what to do to stop this sort of thing happening again. So it's a good thing, and it is to be encouraged. There's no shame in falling victim to a cyber attack, and there shouldn't be shame in falling victim to a cyber attack, I believe. So the easier we make it for people to talk about it and to report it and to be open and candid about what's going on out there, the better off we all are.
Yeah, I mean, we've often spoken on this podcast how cybersecurity and IT more generally benefits from a more neurodiverse workforce. You know, so it's a space where there are possibilities for people to get jobs and develop skills and things like that. And Claire, you've got a story about that sort of thing, haven't you?
Don't you know it? So the story in question is something that I wrote last month about the professional services firm EY opening what they've called Neurodiverse Centre of Excellence in the UK in Manchester. So as far as I could tell, this Neurodiverse Centre for Excellence is aimed at creating a good space for people who might have a condition such as ADHD, autism, or dyslexia to work as part of a tech innovation team, working on technologies such as AI, data analytics, cybersecurity, blockchain, automation, all of these exciting technologies. And part of the reason for doing this is that obviously people who think in a different way can often come up with creative solutions to problems that may not have crossed the mind of someone else, for example. And I know that we've spoken about that in terms of diversity in general. So the more people that you have on a project, the different sort of thought processes and mindsets and solutions that get developed, you're more likely to cater to a wider range of people. So I think that's kind of what they're aiming for. And the Neurodiverse Centre of Excellence that EY has opened in Manchester is initially going to employ about 6 people, with the aim of employing up to 100 people over the next 3 years. This isn't the only thing that they do in order to make their offices an inclusive place for people. So they also cater to people with these conditions inside their other offices as well. But this is a project specifically to focus on innovation in those tech areas that I just mentioned. But one of the things that I thought might be interesting to talk about is, Alex, we were chatting about a piece that one of your freelancers did about people who are neurodivergent in cyber, and there was a discussion about the different type of language to use and which is more accessible and which people prefer. What did you find out, or what did your freelancer Nick find out?
So Nick wrote exceptionally good feature on what neurodivergent people really think about working in cybersecurity and some of the, you know, some of the pathways that they've taken. And Nick is also autistic himself, is very open about that, so I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying on the podcast. And is also one of the best freelancers that I know. So shout out to Nick. But essentially, there's a school of thought that says that we shouldn't be using the term neurodiverse anymore, that neurodivergent is a better measure, because and the basis for this on my reading seems to be that one cannot necessarily be diverse on one's own.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. It's sort of
diversity is a measure of difference in a large group of people.
Okay.
So to say somebody is neurodiverse is, I guess, a little weird.
So an individual is neurodivergent. What about a group of people?
That's where I'm unclear. I think possibly we can still say neurodiversity there, but I'm very open to being corrected by anybody who cares to write in.
It makes me wonder whether
or tweet us or whatever.
Tweet us at Computer Weekly. It makes me wonder whether the term neurotypical is acceptable as well.
I've wondered about that before reading Nick's feature, actually, because typical there are implications in the words that we use, and I none of us are typical as such, I wouldn't say. But and neurotypical, I don't know, it's difficult. As someone who is not neurodivergent personally, it's hard for me to say, and it's also not really my place to say.
Or is it though, because you would be classed as neurotypical, I guess, if you don't have a condition like ADHD, autism, dyslexia, and whether it's okay to say people who have these differences. Again, like Alex said, open to being corrected. I want to use, you know, like terms that make people feel comfortable. But I just thought that this discussion around language was very interesting.
I'm going to try to use neurodivergent going forwards, but I think it's up to people who are part of the group in question, not part of the dominant group, to say what language they would want to use. I can, you know, I can invoke, you know, invoke my status as a gay man to say whether or not I feel comfortable being called queer, but I wouldn't want to be dictated to by a straight person on that, and it wouldn't be appropriate for a straight person to dictate to me on that. So, but equally, I don't get to say what I don't get to go around dictating to black people or to neurodivergent people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, I agree. And that's maybe a conversation for another time.
No, but there was a statistic in your piece, Claire, which really arrested me. I think it was an ONS statistic that 22% of people with autism in the UK are unemployed. I just thought, my God, that's a lot. It's a big percentage.
One of the people who spoke at one of our previous diversity in tech events, Rachel Morgan Trimmer, she did a workshop on being neurodivergent and what it means for, you know, like some people. And she said that people often avoid hiring people who might have a condition like ADHD, autism, dyslexia, or, you know, like a neurological difference.
Yeah.
Because you have to make adaptations in the workplace, and that seems like a really big scary thing. But the types of adaptations that you need to make might even be as small as making sure that the lights above someone's desk don't flicker, or, you know, like making sure that people are in an environment where they can concentrate, or, you know, some of these changes, that they're not a massive thing, and they will probably be different for each individual, but it shouldn't be something that would put you off tapping into a talent pool that potentially are extremely creative and innovative.
So I've got a little story about space. Space junk, in fact. Now, did you know that 85% plus of what's orbiting the Earth is debris? It's bits of old rockets. It's all sorts of junk, really. Now, this story, it did remind me a little bit of watching Don't Look Up on Netflix, which I very much enjoyed. And the kind of Leonardo DiCaprio of this story is a chap called Moribajá, the rector of computational astronautical sciences and technologies for the Odin Institute at the University of Texas at Austin, so quite a mouthful. And what Moribajá and his team have done is build a graph database using tech from Neo4j. And I was thinking while I was preparing this story, when's the last time I spoke about graph databases on the podcast? And I think it was in our very last in-person podcast, which was published on the 18th of March, 2020. That was, again, was a Neo4j case. Other graph databases are available. That use case was about money laundering. And the basic question that the graph database was, you know, tasked with answering is, who owns what? I mean, who really owns a company? It's actually quite a difficult thing to figure out. Even so, this time I had to remind myself of what a graph database is. Jumping onto whatis.com, our brilliant resource for this kind of thing. Whatis.com gives the example of a family tree. So it's basically connecting entities, you know, people, it could be companies, it could be people. But the space case is quite similar. I suppose it comes down to who owns the junk. So that's kind of what it's about. Morib told me he got the idea for using graph technology from a TV program which he watched, which showed how you could identify people who are cheating on their partners by using a combination of data sources. So like telephone directory information, but also Uber ride records, that kind of thing. If you put things together, you can infer like who's cheating on their partner in a particular neighborhood or whatever. And he thought, I want to do that for space. So that's what they've set out to do. Claire?
As in using data to see whether aliens are cheating on their partners.
So I wish it was as rococo and bizarre as that. But no, it's about kind of identifying the junk and who owns that junk. And as I said, they built this graph database. It's called AstriaGraph. There's a link in my story to the graph itself. And I put a link in the article so listeners can play around with the graph for themselves. It's quite an interesting thing to do. Now, Moribajá himself, he started his career as a security specialist for the US Air Force. He spent over 7 years at NASA as a spacecraft navigation engineer and over 8 years at the US Air Force Research Laboratory. So he knows about space. That's all I'm saying there. He really does know about space. And I put to him Claire's classic question from another podcast, are you the sort of person who would go into space? And he said, nah, not me, man.
Mm-hmm.
You could go.
He knows what he's talking about. Why would you? It's dangerous. Nobody knows what's out there. You don't even know what's in the sea. Why go into space?
Absolutely. And he counseled against space tourism. I think that's a very, very bad idea. He said it's like getting on an aircraft, but you're being told that there will be stray bullets fired at your aircraft. Have a good flight. Because of all the space junk that there is. And it is quite disturbing to find that there are more than 26,000 objects in near-Earth orbit, and about 3,500 of those serve a useful purpose, like the International Space Station and other useful things, but the rest is junk. So about 13.5%, getting the calculator out, is useful, and the rest of it is debris.
Well, because humans are a scourge. We fucked up Earth and now we've decided to send a load of shit into space as well. Where? Oh, humanity, man. I swear. Yeah.
But that is such an interesting point, Claire, because I mean, if you think about the COPs, like COP26, we were discussing on a couple of podcasts at the end of last year, that doesn't really extend to space. And yet quite near to the Earth, there is all this kind of shit orbiting our planet. But there are people trying to do something about it. And his effort is the beginnings of kind of helping with that, at least kind of identifying what there is. Now, there is a thing I found out called the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs, UNOOSA. And the Astrograph people, Moriba and his team have, you know, been kind of working with them and helping them out and things like that. It did remind me, just finding out about this, that of, you know, the Planetary Defense Coordination Office in Don't Look Up, which apparently really exists. And talking to Moriba ever so briefly, I only had like 20 minutes with him or something. There is clearly a whole space community. He was at a space conference and he was about to go into a panel with various people, including a company that wants to kind of clear up space junk. So there is a whole kind of community of people who are focused on this stuff and think about it all the time. I did ask him what he wanted. And he had quite a nice quote. He said spontaneously, "I'd like humanity to embrace near Earth as a finite resource that is in need of environmental protection, just like land, air and ocean." Although obviously we have polluted the land, the air and the ocean as well, but so not treating near Earth space like that, but nevertheless, it should receive more attention than it does. So I think the project is interesting. His whole concept is to render space kind of transparent, to make sure that nothing hides, because at the moment it is, to use a term that Caroline used earlier, a bit like the Wild West up there. All sorts of people shooting up all sorts of satellites and rockets into space. Our colleague Joe Halloran always seems to be writing about, you know, yet another satellite has been launched and so on. So it's kind of getting a regulation again into that and making sure you're able to identify who owns the junk and how compliant people are being with the various UN regulations that in fact, you know, there are. It's taken quite a long time to develop. That's the Astrograph.
It's the kind of interview where the subject and the subject matter that they're specialising in is just so fascinating that I bet it must have written itself. You can just sort of sit back and enjoy it. I've done a couple like that myself, where I've just found the person so interesting that I could just sort of sit there and listen to them talk for ages. So it's a great piece, and I commend it to the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. I think what's also quite challenging about those kind of interviews, where you're interviewing a kind of brain the size of a planet academic type person who isn't, you know, like from a vendor, you know, they don't have to be nice to you if they, you know, like the way that a vendor would be, have to be nice to you. And you know, they're so specialized in their knowledge and so smart anyway that it becomes you know, becomes quite a kind of a very interestingly challenging type of interview. Like I said, we'll include a link to the Astrograph itself so listeners can play around with it. And indeed to all the stories that we've mentioned in the episode. You can read those in the article that goes with the podcast and listen to the podcast itself on computerweekly.com. And subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Amazon Music. And if you want to give us a nice rating, that would be good. If you want to give us a not nice rating, maybe kind of desist from that. I think sadly that's all we've got time for this time around. Thank you ever so much for joining us today, Alex.
You're Very welcome.
A pleasure to have you back. And as always and as ever, thank you to you, Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you to you, listener, very much for listening to us talking. Very good of you. So until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.